Dottle.
It's Dottle Talks Tech with James DeRuvo.
Never touch another man's butt.
Online at dottlenews.com.
The history of digital technology is the topic of today's Dottle Talks Tech. And with me is Phil Tippett, the founder and namesake of Tippett Studio. He's had a varied career in visual effects that has spanned more than 30 years. He's won 2 Academy Awards, 6 nominations, 1 BAFTA Award with 4 nominations, 2 Emmys, and in the advent of modern digital effects in motion pictures, Phil Tippett has gone from pure stop-motion animation as seen through various classics that inspired him, like The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad and King Kong. He started with George Lucas in Star Wars and has gone through from Empire to Jurassic Park with Steven Spielberg, and most recently has been featured in films such as The Immortals. Mr. Tippett, thanks for joining us on Dottle Talks Tech.
My pleasure.
You've seen a lot in the last 30 years, these brand new bleeding edge technology of motion control and stop motion animation and going all the way through up to computer graphics imagery. What got you into this business?
Oh, I was just a kid that fell in love with, this kind of material. I mean, the lightning rod that kind of struck me when I was 7 years old was the release of The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad in, Ray Harryhausen films. And, prior to that, in, 1955, King Kong came on television. So, I had no idea what I was looking at there, but that was the spark that got me, inspired to kind of track this stuff and follow it and just trying to figure out what the hell I was looking at.
Were you making Super 8 films when you were a kid? How it starts?
That's how it started. I had to mow a lot of lawns, and I bought a single-frame Keystone 8mm camera and would shoot, because they were expensive for, a kid back then. And, the film itself, 8mm is actually 16mm, and you shoot one half of the roll, and then you reverse it, and you shoot the other half. So it just takes forever, months and months and months to do animation tests, and then you send it back to Rochester, New York, and a month later you get your film back, and there's a total disconnect, in terms of what you're trying to understand and learn. And then I liken it to playing a piano without being able to hear what you're playing, and then hearing it a month later and trying to figure out what you did. So that was, we did not have the digital technology today where you can actually shoot something and play it back and get immediate feedback. So the learning curve was very flat.
Did you go to film school?
No, I did not. I went to art school. I couldn't afford film school. I went to UC Irvine and was in the fine art department there.
Fine art department.
And they had one film class at UC Irvine that was taught by the guy that played the piano in Roland Martin's Laugh-In. So we didn't get a whole lot of, tricks taught to us.
So you moved on and was working with Lucas, was that your first major job? Did they throw you in the deep end of the pool?
Well, I wouldn't say we got thrown in. I mean, we really aspired to it. I mean, prior to that, we'd done, I met, a bunch of the guys that, have gone on to become kind of preeminent, visual effects supervisors like Ken Ralston and Dennis Muren and John Berg and Tom Santamon and these guys. We all found a perch in a commercial company in Hollywood called Cascade Pictures. And that our mentors were Jim Danforth and Dave Allen, who worked there. And so that was kind of where we cut our teeth. We had a great boss. His name was Phil Kellison, that had worked on Jack the Giant Killer and Giant Behemoth, worked with Willis O'Brien in the past. And Phil, ran this shop. And there was maybe 5 of us that were really into this stuff at the time, stop motion. And, you know, Phil kind of, you know, let us use the tools and come in on the weekends. And, you know, it was a really great, you know, it was kind of like a graduate school for trying to figure out how to do this stuff with actual, you know, tools.
And so I remember reading the behind the scenes of Star Wars many years ago, talking about just how bleeding edge the technology was that you were using in that sweltering warehouse in Van Nuys back in 75.
Yeah, well, our relationship, you know, my relationship to the Star Wars project was the result of, you know, Dennis Muren and Ken Ralston got hired on, you know, years before I was involved, and they were shooting all the spaceships motion control, and I would go out and visit them. They were both on the night crew at that point. Dennis was shooting and Ken was his assistant, and I'd go out and check out things there. And towards the end of the production, it came up that George needed to flesh out the cantina scene. He didn't have quite all the material that he needed, and so Dennis pitched having Rick Baker lead a pack of out-of-work stop-motion animators, Doug Beswick and John Berg and Lane Liska and Doug and myself, and I think Rob Botine was part of the mix too, got a little warehouse space, and in a period of about 6 weeks bashed out a bunch of, you know, background characters. Then we went to a little insert stage on La Brea Avenue, and George directed us. We wore the costumes that we built, and Carol Ballard shot it, and that we shot all these inserts over the period of a couple of days. And during that time, George became aware I had some of my stop motion puppets that I brought into the warehouse, and that's where he got the idea of doing the little chess sequence as a stop motion set.
I was going to ask you about the chess sequence. That was supposed to be a holographic chess set, but it was all done in stop motion.
Yeah, initially George was going to have people in costumes performing. But I think Michael Crichton had just come out with Westworld, and there was something kind of similar in that. And George wanted to do something different, and when he became aware that, you know, there were a bunch of stop motion guys that were available, he decided to go in that direction. And he actually, one of the puppets that he saw that I had at when we were doing the cantina masks, he asked if, well, could I put that in my movie? And I'm like, yeah, sure, why not? You know, if you hire me, you know, I'll throw it in with the deal. And so he just said, yeah, just here's what I want. And we went into ILM. We looked at the background plates that had been shot, and he explained the scene and just said, yeah, just come up with a bunch of monsters that you can animate. And we did. So in the period of about a week, John Berg and I lashed together about like 8 or 10 of these little creatures, plus the thing that I had, you know, previously built. And we brought him into George. He went, okay, great. And then we shot it in the, you know, over a couple of evenings. In fact, the nights that we were shooting was actually the wrap party at ILM proper. So we were just, you know, probably the last, you know, few frames of film that were shot on Star Wars was for the chess set.
And then in 1978, you guys started work on Empire Strikes Back and the infamous AT-AT Walker scene.
You know, the whole association with George was, you know, something that we had, you know, always aspired and dreamed to do, because back in the day, you know, there were no stop motion movies being made, movies that employed stop motion at all, other than Ray Harryhausen. And so, you know, George was of that generation, you know, that kind of grew up on that stuff like we did. And, you know, there were a bunch of ideas that were pitched around, you know, prior to it landing with being the Walkers being stop motion. At one point, there were going to be big radio-controlled wheeled vehicles. But I think, you know, Dennis Muren and Joe Johnston, who was, you know, the visual effects art director at that time, you know, kind of nudged George, you know, towards doing him as stop motion characters.
So in 1984, you leave ILM to strike out on your own with Tippett Studios.
Well, that wasn't really my intention. You know, I didn't ever plan to. I always wanted to have a workspace studio where I could do the kind of apply stop motion in a way that I wanted to do, which was a little bit different than theatrical cinema. But there were some things I kind of had to get off my chest first, so I kind of took a break after Jedi and Dragon Slayer, and spent about a year doing a short stop-motion dinosaur picture called Prehistoric Beast, which was only about 12 minutes long, just to immerse myself. That was kind of my Lucasfilm graduate project. I'd learned a lot working with George and you know, Dennis and ILM, and I wanted to apply that to actually, you know, making a short film of my own and coming up with a scenario and, you know, getting all the sound effects and music and all that kind of stuff together. And that, once I had completed that, that kind of ran across the radar of a producer in New York who wanted to produce a dinosaur special on television, which was called Dinosaur. It aired on CBS, and Christopher Reeve narrated it. And that was kind of the beginning of Tippett Studio. It just literally went from, you know, my garage to a small 1,500-foot square foot workspace. And we did this CBS dinosaur show, and you know, it was about a little kind of a neighborhood of dinosaurs that roughly approximated the latest paleontological information about dinosaurs and how they lived and, you know, how they interacted together. And that was really the beginning of Tippett Studio. It kind of snuck up on me, you know, and then it just kind of went job to job from there. You know, I would work back and forth at ILM doing, you know, various pictures, Howard the Duck and The Golden Child, you know, while interspersed with you know, Joe Johnston's directorial debut, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, and we did RoboCop. And, you know, my friend John Davison, who I'd worked with and met on Joe Dante's Piranha movie, became friends. And John was kind of my champion in turning work my way and trying to find and develop material that, you know, we could do some cool stop-motion creatures for. And that began, you know, my protracted relationship with John, and we went on to do, you know, the three RoboCops and, you know, Starship Troopers together.
And Starship Troopers was pure CGI, so let's hang on that and get to 1991, where Steven Spielberg comes to you and drops the bomb. Tells you, you know, I love that stop motion, but that's not where we're going.
Yeah, well, you know, it was kind of the story started a little bit earlier where John Davison and Paul Verhoeven and I were developing a dinosaur movie at Disney that we wanted to be a full length, almost more documentary style, more silent film. It would have a symphonic score, and we got, you know, Waylon Green, who's a terrific writer, wrote a screenplay. We developed it at Disney. We're going to do this big stop motion dinosaur show, and then we kind of ran afoul of Disney because they wanted the dinosaurs to talk and sing and all of that stuff. But I was still kind of hot on the dinosaur wavelength, and I got a call from Kathy Kennedy and Steven Spielberg, and they said, "Hey, we got this dinosaur movie that we want to do," and they sent me, it was before they sent me the galleys of the novel, Crichton's novel, and it all kind of started there. I mean, Steven initially wanted to do as much as he could with full-scale props and robotics, but that he couldn't get all of the action that he really needed, so you know, Dennis Muren and I were brought in along with Stan Winston. We started discussing, you know, how we were going to develop it. And at that point in time, the confidence level in computer graphics was not that high to be able to actually do, you know, convincing living creatures. And so we started out developing everything with, you know, stop motion, go motion, high speed miniatures, all that kind of stuff. And Dennis had planned on doing the, there's a herd of ostrich dinosaurs that run through a scene. And he was experimenting with having those done in long shots as computer graphic characters. And they did a number of tests, and the more they punched into the camera, the more they refined the details, it proved that there was, you know, the technology was at a point where, you know, lifelike, you know, flesh and blood creatures, you know, could be done with computer graphics. And Steven saw the tests and saw immediately the opportunity to, you know, show something and increase the spectacle level and awe of, you know, what he needed for what were going to be the real stars of his movie, the dinosaurs, and decided to go that way. And so I kind of saw it coming from, you know, about 100 miles away, but there was an edict at a certain point that, you know, it was all going to be done with computer graphics. And so that was kind of a shock, you know, because at that time, the whole world of stop motion, you could just see crumbling, and, you know, the future was really going to be about, you know, digital imagery.
So you, at this point, you're really faced with the whole notion of dinosaurs becomes a metaphor of evolve or die.
Exactly.
So you, yeah, had to evolve, and essentially your company had to teach itself CGI on the fly.
Well, you know, it was, fortunately, we had a little bit of a toe in the water kind of a situation. You know, we were able to pony up with a 800-pound gorilla at ILM who had been, you know, at the forefront of all of this stuff with Young Sherlock and The Abyss and Terminator 2. So Dennis Muren was, you know, really well versed in the, you know, production approaches that needed to happen with, you know, digital work. At that time, there weren't that many digital animators out there that, you know, that mostly what digital animators did was to create like flying logos or little cartoony type characters, and to actually engineer things that actually fit into a photographic background plate that had the appearance of weight and mass and could actually act was very limited. It was just hard to find that workforce. So we came up with this interim solution, which we call the Dinosaur Input Device, the DID. And my buddy Craig Hayes and Rick Sayre, who's now at Pixar, and Brian Knapp, developed this process whereby we created stop-motion armatures that have sensors in them that would plug into the computer, so stop-motion animators could actually animate these articulated skeletons and get the performances, because the kinds of intuitive and kind of sculptural approaches that a stop-motion animator would take are very different from the way computer graphics animators worked at that time, and a great deal of the intention and approach working with one's hands. You do a lot of things that are kind of counterintuitive that the computer doesn't think of, you know. So it was kind of this interim device, kind of like Go Motion was. You know, it was like a device that allowed us to get to the next phase using the skill and talent of people that actually knew how to drive the characters. So we use these DID devices for primarily the Raptor Kitchen and the main road scene with the Tyrannosaurus.
Is that the kind of was the DID kind of the forerunner of the motion control suits that they use today?
Well, it was motion capture, literally, you know. Yeah. So, yeah, it was
bleeding edge again.
It was some of the first stuff that was being done, you know, like that. Yeah, and immediately after Jurassic, I picked up a small job, a Martha Coolidge picture called Three Wishes, and there's a creature in that. And we did that all primarily because I couldn't find any really competent CG animators. I hired a buddy of mine that was a performance artist, and Craig built this motion capture suit, and we did all the performances in real time with a real actor instead of doing stop motion. I'm not particularly, wed to any particular process. I'll do, whatever works. So, it was the right technique at the time for us to do that show.
And so, in the process of creating the dinosaur input device and learning CG and getting into CGI on the fly, you win your second Oscar for visual effects on Jurassic Park. And then you moved into you mentioned Starship Troopers. That was what, around 2000? No, that was in the 90s, late 90s, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was released in 97.
Yeah, 97.
In fact, I'm going down a week from today to Los Angeles. They're having the 15th year Starship Troopers reunion down there. So I'll
Wow.
be attending that.
I remember being very impressed with the level of complexity of the CGI with the bugs. And some of that work was, you could tell, going from the Gallimimus stampede in Jurassic Park to the bugs in Starship Troopers, and then even getting into the CGI work that was done in movies like The Lion King, you've definitely seen a progression of how that whole state of the industry has advanced.
Yeah, well, you know what? And what's kind of amazing to me, and other people, have mentioned this as well. If you go back and look at some of that stuff, like Jurassic Park and Starship Troopers, in many ways, it holds up a lot better than a lot of work being done today. And it was just those pictures were made at a different time with directors that were much more old school and were very adept at. Yeah, working on visual effects movies and worked much more in the vein of like Alfred Hitchcock, where it was all about the planning and organization for what the intention was. A lot of stuff that's done today is much more, shot on the fly and kind of fixed later in post-production. But those shows, and Terminator 2, all of those like hold up in many ways, better than a lot of shows that are released, within the last couple of years.
And most recently, you did some of the visual effects works in the Immortals is really cool. I really like that. Isn't that the one where the guy has the bow of light, where he's firing the bow and it shoots the shafts of light?
Yeah, well, we just worked on one small scene where the bad guys get beat up by the good guys, and there's a great deal of mayhem where guys are being cut in half and squashed and run through and losing appendages right and left, and a lot of that material was needed to be shot. Tarsem Singh wanted it to be all shot at like 500 frames a second, and there was really no easy way of doing that and integrating all of these effects other than creating a bunch of digital characters. And the supervisor on that show on our team was Matt Jacobs, and Greg Hayes was involved in helping to lay out and design all of that stuff. And it was quite a complicated deal. Again, the layout for it was very much like Ray Harryhausen did in The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. He worked with a choreographer, and we had stuntmen that would rehearse and rehearse and rehearse the scenes with live actors, and then Tarsem would pull the stuntmen out, and once the actors understood what their beats were, they kind of shadow box invisible characters. And then we went back onto a motion capture stage, and the stuntmen reperformed their actions, And then we used that as the basis to build upon. And then there was a great deal of like keyframe animation to get the characters to, you know, really come to life. Because motion capture itself gets you like maybe, you know, 90% there, but it's like that last 10% that, you know, is missing in most of, you know, straight motion capture. And so you have to go back in and get the performances that, you know, are missing.
So in looking at the motion capture work that is currently being done today, I'm thinking of the work that was done in Tron. They even use it on the Star Wars Clone Wars episode. What are your thoughts on how fast that is progressing? Because it seems like the state of the art is going faster now. Like Moore's Law, you know, Moore's Law that the power of a chip doubles every 2 years. It almost seems like the state of the art in special effects doubles almost every 2 years. It's amazing what we're seeing now.
I think there's a certain level of refinement, but like what we were talking about earlier, I mean, we were doing, you know, motion capture, you know, back 15 years ago. Certainly, you know, tools have become more refined and the processing power has allowed, you know, everything to speed up significantly. But there's a bit of a stasis, you know, in terms of, you know, the development of new tools. The tools are being refined, you know, but pretty much everything that you're seeing right now that is technologically that's happening are things like, you know, 3D that goes back, you know, years. People were thinking about that in the, you know, 20s and the 30s, and, you know, higher frame rates and all this kind of stuff. Doug Trumbull was working with higher frame rates for amusement park rides back in the 70s. So a lot of this stuff is, you know, ideas that have been cooking for a long time that have just kind of been waiting for the technology to catch up with.
What are your thoughts on the higher frame rate debate with Peter Jackson screening 10 minutes of The Hobbit at 48 frames a second in 3D, and getting a surprisingly, overwhelmingly negative response to it? What are your thoughts? Do you think we're just being resistant to change? Is it really? Do you think that's going to be the future?
You know, I haven't seen the Jackson material, but and the only 60 frame per second material I saw was some promotional stuff that Doug Trumbull had done back in the 70s at 60 frames a second, and I thought that stuff looked pretty darn good. It's a different cinematic experience. It's just because the persistence of vision is just so, you know, monumentally increased. It gives a very different kind of a picture effect that I find actually preferable to 3D, but you have to kind of find your range in there, and 60 frames a second, I think, kind of sort of works. 48 frames a second has this tendency to make everything look like, you know, an old, you know, like serialized Days of Our Lives video program, where it just...
That soap opera effect, yeah.
You just see too much, you know, and you know, there's so much in cinema and shooting and in the direction of the photography that and the lensing that's so much about what you don't see. I mean, you know, I've seen there's some ability that you can take you know, existing movies and you can increase. And interpolate frames and actually get a great deal more information in them. And you could go back and look at old movies and all of a sudden you just see too much and everything looks terrible. It looks like a crappy video. And, you know, there's a great deal to the artistry of not making everything sharp. You know, there's the kind of this hubris of technology of like, oh, you know, we have the ability to shoot 10K. You know, it's like, okay, well, you certainly do. But, you know, back in the day when we were working with, you know, like Nikon lenses, you know, Nikon was, you know, making the sharpest lenses they could possibly make. And we spent most of our time coming up with diffusion filters to break them up.
To soften it down. Or, you know,
yeah.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I'm not much of a 3D fan myself. I think a little goes a long way with 3D, but and I do like greater resolution in favor of it. But I don't necessarily know that for me, it's kind of a. I know there's the thought there of let's get the audience completely immersed in the experience, and therefore make it as realistic looking as possible. But I go to a movie to be told a story, so I don't necessarily want to be. Want it to be ultra realistic. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, well, movies are pretend. you know, chasing the tail of reality is it seems like, you know, the wrong path to go down. I mean, it's all about, you know, the imagination and how you actually craft a narrative and tell a story and work, you know, kinesthetically. So, you know, I mean, David Lynch is wed to some old video camera that I think is like, you know, less than 2K. It's like, you know, 1500 or 1200 or something like that, because he likes the look, and it looks more, the degradation of the image is aesthetic, you know, in his eyes. So as an artist, he certainly prefers that.
Some say it's kind of like when we went from silent films to sound, and we went from black and white to color, that it's just a resistant to change, and eventually you just get used to it. But then again, some of my favorite movies are in black and white.
Yeah, some of my favorite movies are silent. I mean, there's, you know, Guy Madden is making, you know, motion pictures today that his thesis is kind of like, well, cinema took the wrong turn when it went to sound, you know, and there was a lot in silent storytelling that has gotten, the baby's been thrown out with the bathwater. So, yeah, there's a certain amount of, I mean, you go back historically and look at all these big technological changes, and a lot of times, you know, what you do see, you know, is a somewhat of a regression until, you know, the filmmakers and the storytellers kind of catch up with the tools and figure out actually, you know, how to really use them to their advantage.
So looking over the horizon, you've been in this business now for around what, 40 years now?
Oh God,
at least. Looking, and you've seen this progression from stop motion to go motion to motion capture and 3D and moving into CGI and digital technology. Where do you, in your mind's eye, where do you see us all going?
Well, you know, I'm not that much of a visionary, and quite frankly, I really don't care. You know, I'm more of a craftsman mentality, and, you know, I'll just work with the tools that are available as they come up and that I can afford. So, you know, I mean, a lot of the stuff that we're seeing now is partially a lack of confidence on the part of, you know, filmmakers and studios in terms of how you sell a movie. And I think that as a result of, you know, I mean, something that Spielberg and Lucas, you know, figured out and reinvigorated in motion picture history was by using visual effects as another way of upping the spectacle quotient. And that helps sell the movie because you can get people into the theater, and this is something that the marketers figured out, and certainly the bandwagon that a lot of this stuff is on is to, you know, make the images sharper, make them faster, make them 3D, you know, and that's part of the salesmanship of, oh, this is the latest, newest stuff, you know, and somewhat is driven by the marketing. And it's why you see so many of these visual effects movies, I think, have gotten to this point where you don't even want to see them, because it's just the spectacle quotient is like drinking from a fire hose. You know, there's not a whole lot that's magical about it.
And, so it's just eye candy.
It's just stuff. Yeah, it's just
like flash. A two-hour visual effects reel.
It's flashing lights.
Yeah.
You know? So, and, you know, I mean, a lot of it, of what we have been brought by the technology, and this is, you know, the Luddite in me speaking, is, you know, it's brought doing things faster and cheaper, you know. And if you work for the studios, you know, the studios want stuff done for a number,
cheaper,
which means faster and cheaper, yeah.
I'll tell you one thing that I find really interesting is that in the move to make things faster and cheaper, and as things have gotten more powerful, they've also gotten a lot cheaper. The whole notion of the democratization of the industry, where some guy with a computer and a video camera and the right software can make a very compelling movie, even with special effects now, whereas special effects used to be like you had to have a lot of money to do.
Oh, absolutely. Now, many times, if I'm giving a talk, invariably, there'll be parents or students in the audience that will, say, what kind of an education, do I need? What would you recommend in terms of schools for, learning filmmaking, digital filmmaking, animation, whatever? And my take is like, save your money, and, work a day job, and the tools are out there that are very sophisticated. You can have your own movie studio for a few thousand bucks now. And, the zeitgeist and the cultural knowledge that, most students that are passionate about, making movies already know what they need to know. All they need to do is get experience working with the tools, and hopefully they have some talent, and then hopefully if they keep plugging away, you learn empirically by your mistakes. You gain skill, and people don't need to be taught things; they already bloody know it.
Do you think that stop motion is ever really? Could it make a comeback?
I think as it's used, in theatrical feature effects, I think its day has come and gone. But Burton's over there doing Frankenweenie, and Henry Selick's doing his new stop motion picture, and it really is amazing. They're teaching stop motion in schools now. There's kind of a almost kind of a grassrootsy kind of like undercurrent of people that are really interested in that particular process, because it was just, and it's an aesthetic choice, I think, whatever your proclivity is for as an artist or a craftsman, to choose your processes and tools. And, I'm currently, I've kind of, gone full circle, and for years now I've been working on, my own, going kind of back to the roots of making my own stop motion films now. So, I prefer that process, and I prefer that look. And I don't even particularly care for like some of the newer technology that is being used to make stop motion films, which are using frame grabbers. There's this emphasis on perfection in the motion that is coming closer and closer to mimicking computer graphics. And the kind of stuff that turned me on and still interests me is the kind of performances that you can get out of a character by animating actually very quickly and not trying to be a perfectionist and focusing on the actual performance itself. I think a lot of performance that we get, these days can in many ways be denuded because of the tool. I mean, if anything, the computer is more an editorial tool than anything else. And you would, your jaw would drop if you knew the amount of notes that we get from, not just the director, who really is the only person you want to be taking notes from, but everybody in the editorial department and everybody at the studio, and everybody's got because everything, the whole process is so subjective, everybody's making their own movie in their head. And with stop motion, it was like you planned it and you worked on it and everybody was on the same page and you did a performance, and it was much more like a live theatrical performance. That was it. That's what you did, and you made a commitment to it, and it wasn't about always being able to change it.
You mentioned Henry Selick. I remember when he directed Tim Burton's Nightmare Before Christmas. That's the first thing that I thought of when you talked about performance. Is how I was in awe of the performance of the characters. They were real characters in the stop motion of Nightmare Before Christmas.
Yeah, there were some really terrific animators working on that show. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, Nick Park's a really terrific filmmaker. And, you know, I mean, these things will get, you know, fantastic. Mr. Fox was a, you know, relative success. So, you
My
know,
son loves that film.
there's interest in this stuff out there still. I mean, they're teaching it in schools. So, you know, it's just, you know, it's almost like any tool or any process. You know, once it's invented, still has some kind of a value. I mean, there's still people that use looms to weave, you know, but, you know, as an industrial tool, it doesn't make any sense. But there are, you know, craftspeople that you know, find the value in old technology and do, you know, superlative work with it.
Did you see the quote unquote Tupac hologram a couple
No,
weeks
I
ago?
haven't. You know, I've been meaning to, and I keep forgetting. I heard it was pretty amazing.
Well, they kept calling it a hologram, but then somebody pointed out that they were using the same projection techniques that were founded 100 years ago.
Yeah, that's what I heard. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I gotta, if I remember, I'll YouTube that tonight.
One thing I thought was, I think is really fun is with the whole advent of mobile technologies like the iPhone and the iPad to be used for filmmaking purposes. I mean, my son just asked me the other day to download a stop motion app to my iPhone so he could animate his Lego figures.
That's wild. You know,
And
if I only had that, you know, I would have been a happy camper.
I mean, you can use the iPad to shoot, edit, add a certain minimal effects to, and then turn around and use it to distribute all with the same tool.
Yeah, I think as it becomes, you know, more intuitive, and, you know, I don't think, you know, cinema has yet, you know, quite seen its, you know, Mozart or Beethoven yet. So, you know, I hope I'm alive long enough, you know, to find that, you know, genius filmmaker, you know, creature that's living in the future someplace. But I think the technology will allow him to do that. I mean, if you can use, you know, your phone to, you know, make a movie. I mean, that's the equivalent of a sketch pad, you know. And, you know, artists, you know, work out a lot of their ideas on the sketch pad. And if, you know, it's a, you know, limited expense, you can do a great deal of work. And that's where all the effort should go, is not in the technology, but in the work of how the technology is, you know, actually being used. What is it for? You know, what stories are you telling? What kind of, you know, films are you making?
So, what's in the future for Tippett Studio?
Well, we just keep plugging along. You know, it's business as usual. You know, we get jobs and we bid jobs and, you know, take the work in as it comes or as it goes. So, you know, we're just I'm wrapping up the fourth Twilight movie. Now it's going to be the end of that whole franchise, and then we're working on Seth MacFarlane's R-rated Teddy Bear picture, which looks like it's going to be kind of amazing.
Interesting.
Yeah, you know. So it's we're working on you know, the M. Night's new movie, which is a big, you know, future spectacle with lots of weird creatures and stuff. So it's just, you know, more of the same. And we're mostly like a creature character, you know, kind of a place. So, you know, people come to us when, you know, they need that kind of thing.
So it's still more of the Creature Studio.
Well, yeah, I mean, I kind of like, you know, working in that modality, because if you're dealing with a character, you know, any kind of a character, you're involved with the whole process. And I guess that's one of the things that I like about that particular niche. Unlike doing matte paintings or explosions or something like that, you're working on scenes. And so, you know, generally in my day job, you know, I'll be like the, you know, second or third person that's hired onto the crew to help shape the movie, and then get that to design it and get it into a place where it can be shot for the budget that's available, and then go out and with the live action crews and shoot everything so that you can put it back together again, and then come back and do the post-production visual effects work, and, you know, work with the editors and the sound department and all that, and grade the film and take it to, you know, its release print. So you can really see the whole process, you know, and take it from the cradle to the grave. So, you know, it's not like you're just doing a shot or a couple of shots in a movie.
It's interesting that you say we haven't found our Beethoven or Mozart yet, and maybe he's just waiting for the technology to equal his vision. Isn't that what George Lucas used to say? Is that I finally have the tools that I can equal my vision of what I saw when I wrote Star Wars to begin with.
Yeah, I guess. We'll see. I mean, hopefully we won't have to wait 100 years for them. I mean, you know, I mean, I'm being glib when I say that, of course, because, right. You know, there are plenty of, you know, amazing master filmmakers, you know, that have, you know, existed since the beginning of cinema. So, but I do think that, you know, that the approaches to making cinema or moving images, you know, and it certainly doesn't even have to relate to theatrical cinema at all, can you know really open up. It's going to open up a great deal of, you know, experimental filmmaking as well.
Did you see Hugo?
I did.
What'd you think of it?
You know, it's not really my thing. You know, I just I read the book and I really liked the book, but the whole, you know, cute meet boy meets girl thing, you know, I mean, I kind of fall asleep in those kind of movies. But once it got to the point where it was focusing more on the Malay stuff, I really liked that. I mean, I really felt that Scorsese's, you know, it was like a love poem to filmmaking. And then I thought that the second half of that movie was beautiful.
Well, Phil, I want to thank you for joining us on Donald Talks Technology. I look forward to seeing, well, being a guy, I don't know if I look forward to seeing the Twilight movies.
Yeah, I wouldn't if I were you.
But we look forward to seeing what you've got coming up in the future, and thank you for joining us.
Okay, and if anybody's interested, check out the Tippett Studio website. We've got a trailer for the stop-motion movie that I'm making, Mad God, if anybody's interested in that.
That would be at www.tippett.com.
Okay.
You've been listening to Donald Talks Tech. For more information, visit our website at www.news.donaldme.com. Got a question or comment? There's several ways to get a hold of us. You can drop us a line at james@donaldme.com or send a tweet to us @donaldme. You can like us on Facebook and also subscribe and leave us feedback on iTunes. Donald Talks Tech is a podcast from Donald News, copyright 2012. Thanks for listening.